Bethlehem. Hello, I'm Liz, I'm an addict. Is that all right, Liz? Yeah. Like that, yeah. Oh dear, so what time do I stop talking? Half hour, 40 minutes, okay, I can do that. All right, I've not thought about what I'm going to talk about, but I would like to start by saying welcome to anyone that's new, also welcome visitors from overseas and anyone that's new to this meeting tonight. I think it's great going to meetings in other countries. I've been privileged to be able to do that in recovery, and I think we're really lucky. It's one of the many positive things about being in this fellowship. The world becomes a much smaller place. You can go anywhere and meet new friends pretty quickly. Also, thank you, Glenn. Your chair was great. I want to thank you, but also I hate you for it, because now my chair's going to be really shit. You know, say, oh, the 15 minute was all right, but that 40 minute. In fact, I walked in behind a couple of newcomers. They're not here now. And someone was explaining, he was explaining to the girl, yeah, well, they just speak and then you don't share back. He explained the format. And she said, how long for? And he said, one of them's 45 minutes. And she went, God, that's a long time to listen to someone, isn't it? I thought, you're telling me. And then he said, no, but they're really good. And I thought, no, mate. I thought, oh, no. They've got an expectation as well. But they're not here now, so. So I've been coming here for a while now to these meetings. I've not been to this meeting for a long time, actually. And I'm glad to say I don't mind coming to meetings. I know some people really struggle with this, and it's a bit of a chore to them to come to meetings, but they feel they have to. And thankfully, I've never been in that position, apart from when I first come. I hated it, but I don't mind coming. I don't mind coming to meetings now. It doesn't seem like hard work turning up to meetings. And I first come to a meeting in 1998, and I was just out of detox in Islington. I've just done a 21-day blind detox, and I was terrified. And I didn't know much. I thought I knew everything. I knew nothing. You know, I thought all I needed to do was come off an addictive drug, a physically addictive drug. I needed the detox, then I'd be sorted. How little I knew. And even to this day, every year it surprises me how little I knew the year before. It's like, God, you were stupid. You thought you knew so much. This happens all the time. And I suppose the positive thing about that is I've got hope for the future, because I think, wow, can you imagine all the things I'll know in 10 years? It'll be a lot more than now. Thing is, I forget a lot of stuff and all along the way. So my using... you know, I don't come from a using family, and I know people talk about this being a family illness. My immediate family, my parents weren't alcoholics or addicts. However, my extended family up in Glasgow is just running right through it. And I do believe if my parents hadn't moved down to London from Glasgow, you know, they probably would have been as well. But I grew up in an environment where getting off your face and using drugs was the norm. That's what people did for fun. People didn't say, I'm doing this to get away from difficult feelings and I can't express my feelings. It was just a laugh. That's what people did. And at that time, actually, when I was very young, it was like I was quite intrigued by the glue sniffers, because you're talking like late 70s. Yes, I am older than I look. Like, and being really like interested in watching glue sniffers and thinking, what are they doing? And then they'd be shouting really stupid stuff out and all that. And I'd think, God, they're crazy, but being really fascinated by it. And then like being up in Glasgow, because that was our summer holidays, that's how sophisticated we was. We used to go to Glasgow for our holidays, and I loved it up there. And you'd go to the swing park, and people were injecting this in the 80s, injecting heroin blatantly in the swing park. It was just like, so it wasn't a shock to see people using drugs. It's not something I particularly wanted to do. I didn't think, oh, what? That's what I want to do when I grow up. However, it didn't seem as alien to me as it might have done to other people. And pretty much being a teenage girl, it wasn't unusual in school to be getting drunk and getting stoned and that sort of stuff. It was just normal stuff. And when I come into recovery, that's how I separated myself from all you lot, because I'm like, no, I wasn't using because of all this internal stuff. I just liked doing it, and it got out of hand. But when I look back on when I was young, I was pretty messed up from a really young age. That self-loathing stuff, that critical voice you spoke about, Glenn, I know that's been there from really young. And I couldn't tell you where it comes from either, but it's not normal. And you don't realise things ain't normal, do you, until you meet other people and they say, no, I wasn't like that. My self-esteem was always very low. One of my first addictive patterns I could really relate to now from this perspective is not going to school. So I'd bunk off school and get caught, and my dad wouldn't call it grounded because that's too American. He'd just say, you're not going out, and till I say so. So it'd be like week after week, and I'm thinking, shall I ask him, shall I? I might ask him and he'd say, no! Or like, I might ask him, say, you can go out. So it's that. But because I couldn't go out, I used to just bunk off school in the daytime, and it'd be extending 10 weeks at one time. I couldn't go out, do you know what I mean? But it was like, it was that, I can relate it now to that addict feeling, because I'd have every intention of going, I'd get off the bus, and then I'd cross the road and get on the bus back and go around my mate, or we'd go to the pub or whatever, because I was always tall and looked middle-aged, even at 14 years old, so we'd go to the pub or whatever. But that was that addiction, I can really see it now. And what happened was, my friends liked drinking, but the lads, my brother's friends and that, they liked doing acid and pills and stuff like that. And that was very appealing to me. So I used to like do drugs with them and drink with my friends. And I really loved tripping. When I was about 16, I guess, I was really into tripping. And I'd try and get my friends to trip with me. And one at a time, I'd take them hostage for a weekend and they'd never do it again. And so I'd get another one and they'd never do it again. And what happened was I ended up, I was at a Hawkwind's all-nighter thing with my brother. This was, 1991, I think it was. And I don't know if anyone's familiar with Hawkwind, but they're a space rock band. And their fans, you know, even if you weren't tripping off your tits, that would be a freaky place to be, just seeing the other people that was there. And I'd had about... This is actually a really good story to add to my chair, and it's a new addition, because I'd had about four trips that I was sharing with my brother all through the night, and everyone from our area was down there in Brixton. I live in Enfield. And so I was having a great night. I was having a ball. And then I went upstairs to where Spiral Tribe was, and I saw someone I knew, and I said, oh, what you got? And he gave me this microdot. So I said, you've got another one for my brother. So we've got two microdots. And I've gone down there, we've done these microdots, and I lost the plot, totally lost the plot. And my brother had to get me from Brixton back to Enfield at like 6 a.m. on buses. And I remember being here at Trafalgar Square and trying to get the bus driver out the bus to drive the bus home. Not that I could drive, let alone drive a bus, tripping, screaming, trying to pull this bus driver out. My brother was just trying to hold... He's had as much as I'd had as well, bear in mind. He's trying to hold it all together. And he actually punched me, and I hit my head against the sort of recycling bin. And I stopped tripping. I was actually... For a few seconds, I stopped tripping and I said, just get me home. And he went, that's what I'm trying to do. And then it all went crazy again. And he got me home. And my little brother and my mum and dad was in Glasgow at the time. And he got me in. And I went up to the bathroom. That's the first suicide attempt I'd done. Just cutting my arms, cutting my wrist. Because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was like, why do I keep doing this? Because... I'd had a bad trip before that, and after that I kept having bad trips, but I kept taking them, and I was like, what is wrong with me? I keep doing this. I just need to kill myself. And I'd cut them right, and I'd come down, and bearing in mind he's off his tits as well, and I'm covered in blood. It was horrendous. It was awful. I have made amends for not just for that, but for other stuff to my brother, because God, he saw the worst of my using, really, more than anyone. And now I know that is proper step two stuff, what was going on. I just kept doing it and doing it, expecting different results. And the reason this is a new addition to my chair is because I was at a meeting about 6 months ago with a really good friend of mine. And this man is probably, he's the sort of, the role he plays in my life, I don't see him all the time, but he's a really nice bloke. But he's also someone I feel really safe with. You know, he's tall and, like, I love getting hugs off of him. I don't really like hugging people, but I love hugs off of him. And I feel like he'd really protect me. If I was in danger, he'd really protect me. He's that sort of role. And we was talking about this night at Hawkwind, and he said, was there microdots purple? And I went, yeah. He brought the microdots to that gig that night. Oh, wow. He sold me that microdot. Which led to me being here today, because he sold me that microdot, which really fucked my head up, which led to me becoming a heroin addict, so it's all his fault. I become a heroin addict to self-medicate a psychosis, and you know, I'll get onto that in a minute, and then come into recovery, and I've ended up spending every Monday night with this person who I really love, who's a really good friend, and it's full circle, and it just blew me away when I heard that about him. So, God, I've spent a lot of time in my early years, so I'm going to skim through a lot of the using. Like I said, I ended up on heroin to self-medicate, and I blamed it on my partner, of course, because that's what everyone does, I believe. It's because he was a heroin addict, and I ended up being one. We had a daughter. And it got worse, so I started smoking it, which led to injecting it in different places, and you know, it just kept getting worse and worse. And again, I just couldn't understand why I couldn't just stop. And I didn't access any services either. And you know, I know this is the case for a lot of parents, men and women, because they're scared of social services getting involved and all the rest of it. So no one outside of my using circle knew about my using, apart my brother knew, he saw a lot of it. But they knew that my partner was a user. And in the end, I thought, I've just got to leave him, because that's the only way I'm going to stop. And we split up. But obviously I was in a relationship with someone else, because I wouldn't have had the bottle to just leave someone at that time. And the person I was then in a relationship with did not have my best interests at heart at all, and that didn't go very well. But the flip side of that is it got me into recovery, because I ended up in my rock bottom, had a really good attempt of suicide. And I was in a hospital waiting to see if I was going to die or not, because I was running these tests on my liver. And now I think of it, I was talking to my higher power, but at the time I didn't. I was just sort of thinking, and I thought to myself, if I die, good. If I don't die, I don't know how, but I'm going to get off the gear. And it weren't instant, but within a couple of weeks, I was in that detox up in Islington. Terrified, because when I stopped taking the gear, my psychosis come back again, and I remembered, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm mad, I forgot I was mad, and this is how it's going to be if I stay off the gear. And I just didn't relate it, I didn't connect the drugs to my mental health. I didn't know there was a connection with that. I thought I was helping my mental health by using. I couldn't see that's what was causing it. Thank God I stayed in that detox, because that first night I was so terrified. I thought they was going to kill me. I didn't unpack my bag for the first few days, actually, because I thought I can just get it and run out of there. And thank God my dad said to me, look, I'll come and get you in the morning. Just try and stay that night and phone me in the morning. And I phoned him and said, I'm going to give it another day. And that's what that Just For Today is about. And that's why it's so important. You know, if it seems too much a day, just breaking it down to the next 12 hours and then reassessing the situation, then it makes such a big difference. It's so powerful, that. And this is back in the days when people actually got funding for rehabs and things, and we were so lucky back then, but I didn't want it. I didn't want to go to rehab. But when I look back, I was the only person in that group that didn't go on to further treatment. And I left there, and people said, go to an NA meeting. Because actually, by the third week, I was really having a ball in there. I was having a right laugh, and, you know, my paranoia had gone, and it happened really quickly, actually. And they was like, just go to NA. It's really good. And I thought, well, it can't be that good, because you're in a detox, getting clean again. It's no use to me. I ain't going to be sitting in a meeting for the next, like, however long. So I didn't have any intention, but someone gave me one of these. She was a volunteer in there, and she said, just try one. And I went to one, and Glenn, I'm really glad you said that about you didn't find it great when you first come, because I hated it. That first meeting I went to, it was just awful for me. Yeah, it wasn't attractive at all, and all I was seeing was the differences. Like, the person had been using a different drug to me. The secretary was making notes. He was actually making notes. And I'm thinking, what's he going to do with that? Is he going to go to the old bill? And everyone shared in the meeting. And then when they'd finished sharing, they all looked to me to speak. And I thought, yeah, you can... Which I won't say, because I'm being recorded. But I thought, oh, I'm not coming back here again. And another thing that you said, Glenn, about your dad. So I went back to my mum's, because I was staying there with my daughter by this time. And my dad said... And I was making a sandwich, you know, filling the void, the hole in the soul with a sandwich like that, which is, I did often in early recovery. And I'm making this big doorstep sandwich, and my dad said, oh, what was it like then? And I went, oh, it's a load of old shit. And he went, yeah, it's a cult, and they won't let you stop going. And he went, you didn't give them this phone number, did you? Because they'll be looking for you, and they won't let you stop going to it. And I was like, what do you know about recovery? What do you know about addiction? And I started quoting some of the things I'd heard these people I don't like saying in the meeting. And just to piss him off, I went back to another meeting. And I liked what you said, because he's been the same, actually. He's always thought, hoped that I'd stop going to meetings, because he thought, oh, she don't need to be hanging about with them people anymore. But what he has admitted is, he thinks it's great that I've been coming to meetings, but not for the reasons that you spoke about. He thinks it's great because I've met some brilliant... I've got some amazing friends, you know, and the experiences I've had in my life have been mind-blowing and really good. And a lot of the time, that's been because of the people I've met in recovery. So that's why he thinks it's okay for me to keep coming. But you can't put into words what we get out of this. It's not about that material stuff. It's that stuff you spoke about. It's that seeing that light come back in someone's eye that had been out for so long. It's seeing someone have the confidence to share for the first time in a meeting. Because when I first started coming as well, even going to the toilet, it was excruciating. I'm not talking about constipation. I mean, getting up from the chair and walking to a door when everyone's sitting there watching it. Things like that was excruciating. And the first time I did a reading was that Why Are We Here? And it's still my favourite meeting. And that's the first one I read. And I remember it got stuck in my throat about slowly committing suicide. Like, I'd read it and I was like... And it sort of hit me, the severity of the consequences of my using. Because I had a child as well. Like, she'd have been left motherless. And her dad since died as well. So she wouldn't have had any parents if I had died. And it was a slow process for me. I didn't have that pink cloud that I've heard people talk about, because I hated you all and I hated coming to meetings. But I knew if I stopped coming, I would die. It was as black and white. I knew, and I know now, and that's what stops me picking up more than anything. I know when I'm under the influence of drugs or drink, using is a viable option. Suicide is a viable option to me. It's as black and white as that. I think, oh, I'll kill myself. And I can't do that to my family. I can't do it to my daughter. And I certainly don't want to do it to myself anymore. And it's just not worth it. So it was a slow process. And 2 years into it, I did relapse as well. And it wasn't an event. It was a process. And it was a process that started happening about 6 months before I actually picked up. And... You know, it's quite cringy. When I look back to early recovery, my behaviour and my thought processes and the situations I'd get in, I'm like, where was you at? What was you thinking? And it was the addict hadn't stopped just because I'd stopped using. It had grown and it had got more chaotic. And in fact, it caused more chaos because I wasn't in my little cocoon of my flat anymore. I was out in the world being chaotic and meeting other people. And I was in a really bad relationship. And he'd absconded from prison, didn't have anywhere to stay, and picked up. And within 2 weeks, his friend threw us in the back of a van, took him back to prison and took me to a meeting and said, "Don't let her leave, she's used." And I just sat there crying like a pussy all the way through this meeting, like full of shame, and got up and got a white key ring again. That was really difficult, getting up and getting that white key ring after I'd been clean for a couple of years. And the convention was not long after that. And I think I was under 30 days and I was like, there's no way I'm getting up on the stage, because people I knew didn't know I'd even relapse, and it was really painful. Anyone that comes back after a slip is, you know, hats off to you, because so many people don't make it back after that, because the pain and the ego and it keeps a lot of people back out. However, since that day, I've not used since I went to that meeting again, and that was 18 years ago. And I still mourn that 2 years that I lost. I was 2 years and then I really upset. So I was like, I was 18 years clean in February, but it should be 20. Because 18 years is nothing, it's rubbish. So it should be 20. And then I'd get to, by the grace of God, if I ever did get to 25, I'd still be saying it should be 27, you know. I still miss that. However, I didn't lose what I learned in that first 2 years. I did my first couple of steps with a sponsor. I've had a sponsor all the way through, actually, and I've just been visiting my sponsor in hospital. He's an elderly man, and he's in his 70s, but that's not a good description of him. He lives life more than anyone that I know. Calls it hashtag pensioner living. He's off around the world. He never stops. So he's got a problem with his heart. So I've just been up at the hospital visiting him. And we had a really good chat, actually. And he said, "What are you going to talk about in your meeting?" And I went, "Well, at least I can say I spoke to my sponsor today," which is unusual because I don't call him often. And we was talking about different types of sponsorship and how lucky we are in London as well, because it's not easy asking someone to sponsor you. It's a bit like asking my dad if I can go out yet. He's like, "No!" Like building up that courage to ask someone, just to say, "Sorry, I can't." It's painful. But we were saying how some sponsors are more prescriptive and they do things a certain way, and they're the same with all their sponsees. Some are more relaxed. I'm in the more relaxed camp. And he was saying, that's all right. People need different things. Some people need that real disciplined sort of sponsorship when they come in. They need that really firm boundaries. Some people, that would have the opposite effect. And thankfully, in London, it's so diverse in London that, you know, just hang about and you will connect with someone and you'll know that person. Instead of just like asking the first person you see, try and, you know, just listen and get a connection, because we are all very different. And I'm so glad I don't live in a small village where it's the same people sharing the same stuff in the same meetings. It must be quite challenging, I'd imagine. And another good thing about being in London is the amount of meetings a week that we have to choose from. I choose two that I like out of all them meetings. And they're all quite different. And we're really lucky about that as well. So I've sort of found my tribe, if you like, and thankfully a lot of the people in my current group have been around for a long time, like, because I see some people that have lost a lot of friends along the way to relapse, and death, actually. There's been a lot of deaths in the London Fellowship the last couple of years. That's been harsh, because what happens is, just because we stop using drugs, it doesn't mean that life suddenly becomes great and everything goes well. People die and shit happens, and sometimes it's really hard not to use when stuff happens as well. And I've had quite a few events in my life that have been really challenging. But if you ask anyone that's been around for a couple of decades, they would have had some really challenging events happen in their lives. Thankfully, what's happened during them challenging events is I've had a solid support network around me to show me how to put one foot in front of the other when I forget. Because when stuff's really bad, it can be difficult to remember the really simple stuff, like what we do. We turn up, we put our eyes on the seat, we listen, we say hello to a newcomer, and like the power of that stuff. Sometimes I need reminding to do things like that. My daughter's 24 now. I've just been out visiting her in COS. She works looking after kids for Tuit, like for a holiday company. And she's a fantastic young woman. She's like remarkable. And it's funny because we had this conversation. You mentioned your son as well. So she was free when I went into detox and started coming to meetings. And it wasn't until she was about 15, or 16, I think it was, she was going to college. And I said, oh, I'm, because what happened was I went back and worked in that detox. I got cleaning. And they was making this film and they interviewed me in it. And she said, why do they want to interview you? I said, well, because that's where I got clean. And she went, what? I went, yeah, that's where I got off the gish. She went, you used to take drugs? And I went, well, you know I did. You've been going to NA all your life. Like, I didn't have to take her to a lot of meetings because my parents were there and they could baby. But she'd been to meetings. I'm like, why did you think that I was going to NA meetings? And she said, to help other people, which is our primary purpose. But it weren't the only reason I was going. And I was really surprised. I just assumed that she knew. I went, and your dad was a smackhead as well. She went, because he's dead, like. And I'll get back to that in a minute. And then she said, can I have a bit of time to think about this, please? And I went, yeah. That's the thing. When you've got kids growing up, when you're in recovery, they develop this emotional language and it's really uncomfortable because you think, you shouldn't be talking to me about this. Go and talk to your friends or keep it to yourself. It's like, I'm really uncomfortable with it, but she's got this, can I have some time to think about this? And I went, yeah, whatever. And then she come back the next day and she was like, okay, I thought about it. At first I was angry with you, and now I'm really proud of you. I think it's great what you're doing. Oh, well, thank you. She went, but can I ask? It's like, and then she started going through my friends. So he's like, what, Rachel? He's, I'm like, yeah. And she's like, no. And she's like, what, Michael? Yeah, Michael. And then she come up to me an hour later. What, you mean like Julia? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, and then the highlight was, you mean Roz used to take drugs? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, wow. And yeah, it just blew her mind. And we asked her about this last week because Rachel said to her, she went, what did you think your mum was doing? She said, well, she did used to make me put headphones in and listen to music, but she said it's because of the swearing. And I'm like, but I used to swear like a sailor indoors. Why would I make you put headphones in a meeting? So, you know, learn not to make assumptions. Going back to the situation with her dad, we'd split up, like I said, when before I got clean. And then he went off to treatment and he got clean. And he'd just come out of treatment, actually, and he was doing good. He was in a relationship and he was happy enough. And he'd come to pick her up and he asked me to come to the park with him. And he said to me, I've never said this, but I'm really proud of you for getting off the gear and what you're doing, and you're doing really well, and I'm sorry for any bad stuff that went down. And I said the same back to him. And it was really weird. And I even said to someone after, I went, that was a really weird conversation we had. And then 2 weeks later, he died in a motorbike accident. So he didn't know he was going to die. It was 28, he was. He had no idea that was going to happen. And I was on my step three at that time. He was talking about the God thing. I'd been developing some sort of higher power connection up to that point. And I was on step three and I was thinking, well, what's step three going to be like then? Because I do the serenity prayer, I know about this stuff. And I got to step three and I thought, what sort of God would do that to someone at 28 years old? He's doing the right thing and he dies like that. And then as time went on, it was pretty soon after, I remembered that conversation we had in the park. And I thought, that wasn't a coincidence that we got to clear the air just before that happened. And that sort of, from that, my sort of relationship, if you like, with a higher power started developing. And it's been there over the years, and it comes, and it's not a religious thing. I'm not a Christian. I couldn't tell you what it is, but it's a connection. It's some sort of spiritual connection, which I've been working on more recently, actually. And it's stuff that's got me through a lot of stuff, because no matter how wise my sponsor and my friends might be, no matter how what protective factors I've got in place, sometimes no practical things can help me get through stuff. I need something bigger, something more spiritual. Something else that's happened and all in my recovery is my mum developed early onset dementia. And she was in hospital for 8 years. She was dying for 8 years. It was a long time. So that was a big part. That's been a big part of my life. And she died in 2012. But something else you made me think of, Glenn, was that circle of life stuff. Because just before she died, both my brothers had babies. And that's how I remember how long ago she died, because it's how old they are. And it just puts things into perspective. That's what happens. People need to exit for people to come in. And it helps me accept it a bit more, understand it a bit more. My relationship with my dad used to be really volatile when I was growing up, because unlike me, my brothers would just keep their mouth shut and just say, when he's being quite angry and stuff. But I couldn't. I'd always still a bit gobby, but I'm not as gobby as I used to be. So we'd clash, me and my dad, to the point where when I got clean and I was sleeping on their settee, we weren't talking for, I think it was 18 months at that time. So I'd wake up on his settee, he'd be sitting there watching telly, and we wouldn't talk to each other. And we could happily just do that, not speak. And to the point where when the Twin Towers come down, September 11, we was both watching it on the telly, we didn't make a sound because we weren't talking to each other. So I was watching it thinking, because no one knew what was happening, did they? There was a plane flying here and there. It was like the end of the world or something. And we didn't say a word because we weren't talking to each other. That's how committed we were to not talking to each other. And so that's where we was. And then when my mum got ill, as awful as it was, what happened was we had to work together to get the best care for her. And I was able to support him emotionally. Not that he'd ever admit about emotions, but I was able to be there for him. And we was all there when she died as well. And talking about the steps, being related to what's going on in my life, I was on a step 11 at that time when my mum passed away, and I've never had such a profound experience in my life. I was really connected to something at that point. And I was able to organise a funeral, two funerals, we organised a funeral in London. We took her ashes up to Glasgow and had a family thing up there as well. And since then, me and my dad's relationship is just, it's brilliant. It's great. We know each other well enough to not piss each other off. We know what happened as well was he was renting a flat to live near the hospital, so because he was there every day. I mean, he didn't even go to my brother's wedding in Budapest because he wouldn't leave my mum daily. He was there every day. And when she died, he had to move out of his flat. And at the same time, my daughter had gone to live with her boyfriend in Yorkshire. And I said, well, look, her room's empty up there. You can just move in there until you find something. We'll find you something nice. And then as he moved in, my work, I ain't got time to go into it in detail, but it's quite a good story. Catch it on another chair. My work was a mess, and they kept restructuring anyway, and I decided I'm going to go. And I just knew it was the right thing to do. I wasn't anxious or anything about it. I just thought, I'm out of here. I'm not... Because I used to get really anxious about losing my job all the time, really panicked about it. But for some reason, I was thinking, oh, see ya, I'm just going to leave. I might do a bit of temping work. I wasn't worried at all. And at that same time, my dad moved in with me. And when I left that job, he'd had a stroke and he had a heart attack. And he was really ill, actually, really ill. But for the 2 months, I was able to take him to all these hospital appointments and speak for him and all that sort of stuff. And just as he started getting better, I got this temping job, which I'm still at now, actually. This is like 4 years ago. And he's still living with me now because it just works so well. We like the same stuff. He likes watching Breaking Bad and Vic and Bob and things. It's not like your normal 84-year-old. And it's just easy. It's so easy. And I'm so privileged to be able to do that for, you know, for my parent, because like I said, I've lost one, and I'm really making the most of this one while he's still it. Like, I take him to the opera. Like, one of my main purposes is to make the last years of his life as fantastic as they can be. And we're always doing stuff. I've got sponsees as well, and they're great. Again, that is, I'd love to say, I love to sponsor people, and I'm always saying, I'll sponsor you, but that's not how it's happened. What's happened is, people have asked me to sponsor them, and I've been so shocked and taken aback, I haven't thought of a good enough reason to say no. Like, I couldn't think quick enough of an excuse. But thank God that I couldn't, because I probably get more out of that, it sounds like a cliche, than what they do. Because they're brilliant. Like, I've got two sponsees, and they are so smart and they are so on this. And it just blows me away. And I feel sorry for them because I'm their sponsor. And I look at them sometimes and I think, you do know you could get a proper sponsor that could tell you some right wise things. But I don't say that. What I do is, before they come and see me, I have a little prayer in my head. And I think, please just let me be of some use to them when they come. And before I did this chair, in my head, I just thought, please let me say at least one thing that's going to help at least one person in this room, and then I'll know it was okay, because that's what this is about. And then that takes the pressure off of me, because I can negate all the other rubbish for the other 40 minutes. As long as someone in 2 minutes got something, then it's worth it. Because I tell you what, you don't even need to like people to get something from them in this fellowship as well. You know, there might be someone that I really can't stand, but I've heard them share something in a meeting that was the thing that made the difference from me picking up or not picking up about a week later. That's not personality, it's a principle thing. It's so important. It's so clever. This programme is so clever, and them traditions. This stuff really works, but it shouldn't work. Because when you think about where we're all coming from and our backgrounds and stuff, you think, how does this work? How does it function? But it does, because it's so clever and it's so simple. Because all we have to worry about is not picking up a day at a time. And if, like I said, if a day at a time is too long, then it's a half a day at a time. And you know, where I'm at today, I'm really happy. I had a 2016, I'll leave it at this as well, because I think I've got to wrap up. 2016, I had an annus horribilis, and it was an awful year. That's what the Queen called her, awful year. I had an annus horribilis. Mine was in 2016. It was really bad. Probably the worst year I've had in recovery, and I'm talking, I've had some bad years in recovery. That was bad. It just took the piss. And I was in a meeting, and I was crying in this meeting. No, I wasn't crying. I was howling in this meeting. And someone who I didn't know very well gave me a handkerchief, like a proper handkerchief, not a snot rag. And I was crying on it and all the rest of it. And then I put it in my pocket. About a week later, I was really just going back to basics, because I was really trying not to use at the time. Going to work. I had to even get a train to work just so I could read, to distract me from my thoughts, because if I was driving, I was just thinking about everything that was happening, and I just wanted to die, really. And I was waiting for the train. I put my hand in my pocket, and I felt this handkerchief, and I remembered him giving it to me in the meeting. I thought, what a nice man. There's some really lovely people around. And it signified so much to me, this handkerchief. And when I was getting stressed, I used to put my hand in my pocket and like give it a little, like one of them blanket things, give it a little feel and think, oh, and it'd remind me every time I was stressed. And I told this person this story. I went, that's really helped me, that handkerchief, thank you so much. And then about a year later, my friend was crying in a meeting, and he gave her one as well. And I'm like, you've got an annus horribilis as well now. But he told her to break the spell, she's got to wash it, because mine was full of snot still. And makeup. Oh. That's why it went on so long, I think, the bad year. And then he was really ill last year, because we developed quite a nice friendship since then. He was really ill last year, and we went round to play ukuleles to him, and we wrote a song about him. And we bought him a handkerchief and did A-H. She sewed it into the handkerchief to give to him. And it was just like a little symbol of how this works. And it's a nice reminder as well. I've got to mention this before I go, though, because I said about the ukuleles. When I had a really awful year in 2003, And I got through it. I thought, right, I don't know how I got through that, but I'm going to get out there and start living. Off the back of it, I thought, right, there's lots of things I want to do. I'm going to do a step four. I'm going to stop smoking fags. I'm going to learn to drive. I'm going to do all these things. It was a mental list. And I'd done all of them things except for one. And the one thing I put off was getting a bass guitar. I'd always wanted to get a bass, but I've never got around to it. And then 2 years ago, my friend was talking to her sponsor, and her sponsor said, "What do you do for fun?" I think she was doing a step three. And she said, "Oh, I don't know, I run marathons." And the woman's like, "For fun? What do you do for fun?" And she's like, "Well, like my homeless group, they do singing and I really enjoy it." And she said, "Well, why don't you do singing?" So she's telling me this story. She went, "So I looked online and I saw this choir that does all like modern songs, and they do things like Video Killed the Radio stuff." So I'm listening, I'm like, "Oh my God, this sounds great." But I thought, I can't jump on it. This is her thing. So I was in her kitchen going, uh-huh, like that. She went, and I thought to myself, I wonder who else would like to do that. And I thought, you, and I went, "I'd love to do that." I went, can we go? And we went to this choir, right? And this choir is like middle class, like lawyers and doctors and all people like that, and us. But it's all right, because we don't talk to them. So we go in there every Wednesday. So throughout the last few years, and there's been so much going on, we have religiously, every Wednesday, sometime we've been in bits, like crying, and "Are you sure you're all right to do choir tonight?" And we're like, "Yeah," we go in there. It's so therapeutic, because you just switch off from anything that's going on outside, and you sing your bit, you sing your ooh it ooh is or whatever, and it's so therapeutic. And we do concerts a couple of times a year. Who'd have thought, yeah, I'm in a choir. And then what came out the back of that was, she started learning ukulele as well. And then she got me one. I still know two chords. My hands are like Kenny Everett, so I can't do a ukulele. And it's sort of grown. Then she got a guitar, and I thought, this is it. This is what I need to do. I need to get my bass now. And I got it. And it needed... Things happen at the right time, because if I'd got that bass in 23, you wouldn't be able to get Fender Play on a mobile phone that teaches you how to do it. It wouldn't have lasted 2 minutes if I'd got that in 2003. Now I get in from work, I have my dinner, I get my bass, plug it in, I get my lesson on the phone, and I love it. It brings me so much happiness. And it's little things like that, you know. When someone in detox said to me, what do you want now? You've done your detox, what do you want? I went, I just want to be able to sleep and have a shit without needing an enema. That is all I wanted. I didn't want anything else. I didn't think I wanted to join a choir or come here and talk to you lot. That weren't my to-do list, but little things that give me so much joy. Now I've got, like, my nieces and nephews, we've formed a little group with them. They're, like, 7 and all that, the Mini Coopers. So we've got them singing and we're playing our guitars. And who would have thought that I'd be doing that 20 years ago? Because it is 20 years I've been coming, not 18. So it's just make sure you have fun. That's the important thing, I think. Do this stuff, and it is serious, and do it. Don't cut any corners. Do it thoroughly. Do your steps, have your sponsor, have your commitments, but have fun as well. Find out what you like and do it, because what's the point of staying clean if you're going to be miserable all the time? So that's about it, I think, Dean. I'll leave it there. Thank you.